Hey guys, how's it going? We got a great show for you today. We've got Eric Van Workum. It's going to be an awesome show, so stick around.
Guns, gear, and training tips from the best instructors around the world. Walther Arms presents Walther Radio.
Hey guys, how's it going? My name is Chris. Welcome to the Walther Radio podcast. We have been away for quite some time. It's been several months. Got very locked up there with SHOT Show and then Great American Outdoors. But the good news is we actually have some news for you. We did get to come out with two awesome handguns. We had the Steel Frame Compact and the Steel Frame 4.5-inch full-size release at SHOT Show. Two awesome guns, obviously coming off the tail of the Steel Frame Match, which obviously has a dynamic performance trigger. It's got the removable magwell. It's got the lightning cuts. These compact and the full size don't have those options, but there is a couple $100 price break there. Please go check those out at www.waltherarms.com. This episode, just like all other episodes, brought to you by the Walther 30-Day Money-Back Guarantee, which says you can buy just about any Walther that you want, including those new steel frame guns, the PD380, the F-Series PDP, whatever you like. Shoot a million rounds through it if you want within 30 days. If you don't like it, maybe you got a compact and you would have preferred a full size. You got a polymer frame and you would have preferred a steel. You can send that back to us and we will refund 100% of your purchase price up to MSRP. And we'll also give you a shipping label and we will refund your tax that you paid on that. Doesn't have to be a Walther gun either. If you buy a Walther and decide maybe you want something else, that's totally fine. We want you to protect yourself with what you're most comfortable with. Feel free, again, go ahead and use that 30-day money-back guarantee. It is the best guarantee in the industry. At least we feel that way anyway. I think that's it for Walther News. Jumping right in to our guest, he is a very knowledgeable hunter, great friend of Walther, he is really the man behind Muley Freak. Eric Van Workum, how are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing great, man. Thanks for having me. Little struggle getting this thing scheduled, but I'm glad we're finally on track. Yes. Here and synced up today.
Yes. Yeah, me too. It was, there's always scheduling conflicts. Everybody's so busy, it seems like, in this industry.
Yeah, things get a little Western, especially around SHOT Show, Western Hunt Expo. It gets a little wild.
Yes, yes. Can you, just jumping right into this, can you share a little bit about your background and how you first got involved in hunting?
Yeah, man. So I was born and raised on a dairy farm, a Jersey dairy family farm, up here in northern Utah. Started milking cows at 5 years old and just grew up hunting on horses. You know, that's what my grandpa's passion was hunting horseback. And so he took me along as a little kid, 4 year old, on top of a horse. And we grew up pounding the hills with a 30-30 and a 30-06, just cruising saddleback and hunting and farming and playing ball and sports. And I mean, I can't remember not hunting. My grandfather kind of introduced us. Both sides of my mom and dad's family hunted. And so it's just in our DNA. It's what we did. So it's kind of something we've always done.
So is that kind of what sparked your passion for wildlife conservation, was just those old hunting trips?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the horsing element and the outdoor element and then the hunting element. And you know, I only got a taste of it because, you know, as you know, with a dairy farm, the farm never sleeps. You have to milk the cows at 4 a.m. You have to milk them at 4 p.m. If not, they get milk fever, they get sick, they die. Mm-hmm. So we couldn't spend all day in the mountains. So we were up early, you know, 3 o'clock, we're hitting the hills, loading the horse trailer, head up the mountains. And then we had to be home at 3 o'clock to milk the cows again. So I never got to hunt evening hunts. And so naturally we weren't real successful growing up. And I think that also drove my passion to be successful was, hey man, I told grandpa was like, hey, I just like going up and riding the horses and, you know, seeing the animal. I'm like, grandpa, I don't like not getting nothing. And so that really gave me a drive and a passion to be more successful at this because I loved it so much. And I got so tired of coming home empty handed. And it's like Jordan says, the reason why I succeed is because I failed over and over again. And that's how we were. We maybe got a deer or elk, an elk maybe every 5-6 years and maybe a deer every 2 or 3 years. And they were, oh, wow, they were 2 points at that. And I remember these other hunting parties and other dudes shooting these just big old 30-inch deer, gnarly cheaters. I'm like, those deer don't exist. How come we never see those? And I couldn't figure out as a kid, I thought they didn't exist, but it was, we weren't doing it right and we weren't doing it properly. So it just, it just drove me to study it, right? It just drove me to become more passionate about it, because I didn't want to do that. I was tired of coming home empty-handed and not notching tags.
Gotcha. Well, what was the one of the most, if you have to pick one, what's the most memorable hunting experience you've had?
Grown up or recently?
Both.
Yeah. I think growing up, one of the most memorable hunting experience I had is we were saddleback in Wyoming, and we got into a big box canyon, and I was probably an 8-year-old, and me and my grandpa were both leading a horse. So we were on a horse leading another, and we got into this spot where we didn't know if we were going to live or die. We were out of food, out of water. And these were back in the days. We weren't real prepared. We were pretty stupid back then. We didn't really quite know what we were doing. And my grandpa, especially, I mean, he never had more than the jacket or anything, and a pair of Levi's and a flannel. And cowboy boots. That's how we rolled. And, you know, it got to the point where it was so steep, we're so tired and so hungry, it was up to the horse to save our lives. And that's a terrible position to be in. And we literally just grabbed the lead rope, smacked the horse in the butt, and literally had those horses pull us out of the canyon and tried not to get in front of their feet. That was a real memorable experience for me, because it kind of taught me how to be more prepared, what type of clothing to wear. Because growing up, our dads and grandfathers, they didn't know anything different than, you know, a pair of cowboy boots, Levi jeans, and flannel. So that really drove me to research and learn, because I never want to be in that spot again where I'm an 8-year-old fearing for my life. And then most recently, not necessarily a scary situation, but more of actually this guy right there behind me, that big velvet buck in the middle. The name of the film is Tron, and it was a public land archery DIY hunt where we're up at 10,000 feet, and I spotted this deer, and it was an impossible stalk. Like, this buck was 3,500 feet in elevation below us, and we keep in mind, we'd already climbed 4,000 feet in vertical even to get into this hunting spot. We set up camp, we're backpacked in, right? So we're not hunting on horses, we're backpacked in, hunting off our backs, and we spot this deer, and it was an impossible stalk. I don't know how many of your listeners archery hunt, but it was in this big burn, and it's country I'd never been in. And it helps you when you're a bow hunter, when you familiarize yourself with the area. So if you're coming back to the same spot year in, year out, you know the rocks, you know the trees, you know the outcroppings, you know how to hide, you know how to navigate, you know where to stay in or stay out. And I'd made this blind stalk and crushed this 196-inch deer with my bow, and on stalk number one. And apparently there's some guys camped parallel across the canyon from where I killed this deer, and they've been watching him for years. I mean, he had a big drop tine earlier, and he was a well-known deer. And here come Muley Freak Eric in there, Wallace Dunn there, and just smoked this buck on the very first stalk. And it was honestly one of my all-time highlights ever hunting. It was like one of the pinnacles. It was with a bow and on public land in a place that was gnarly. So you had to be physically fit to get in there. And then, you know, I feel like I'm rambling here, but then to piggyback on top of that was my next most favorite thing was when I got to take my son on his first ever hunt this year. Now, I've tried to involve my daughters. Every year I do an antelope hunt or a cow elk hunt where I bring my daughters along. And I started off the bat with three girls. And I thought I was girl dad all the way. And I was championing that, right? I was really excited about that. And I, you know, and Kobe Bryant championed that, and he raised some amazing girls. And I thought I was in that same area until my wife told me she was pregnant one day and we were having a son. And then I'm like, no way. God bless me with the son. And so anyway, getting him up in the side by side, was probably, and I thought Tron, like this big buck behind me, I thought that was like the pinnacle, but getting my son in the side by side with me on the mountain for his first ever hunt was probably the top of my hunting career. And it wasn't a gnarly hunt. It wasn't anything crazy. It wasn't even my hunt. We were just helping another family fill their tag. But having my son with me, who is just loving it, his fake guns, fake binos, he had his own little bino harness with him, and we were potty training him at the time. He wouldn't potty train. And I potty trained him on that hunt on the mountain. I said, hey, you're not going hunting until you poo and pee in the snow. And he actually got potty trained on that hunt. And I was just wiping his butt with sagebrush. So that's the pinnacle. That was my pinnacle of hunting.
What's going to be interesting is when he's being interviewed like 20 years from now on a podcast and he's asked about his favorite hunt, I'm sure that you know, I'd be interested in hearing his side of that.
I would too.
I'm sure that'll be on the list.
It's funny because my wife said, "What's wrong? He's got this rash on his butt." I'm like, "Oh, I was wiping his butt with sagebrush." It was pretty. I don't know if you have any kids, but
I've got two kids.
Yeah, so you can relate to this, like potty training.
Resourceful.
Yeah, you got to be resourceful. Potty training. I'm like, man, I don't know what to do. I don't have a diet. I'm like, nope, commando, and you're learning to poop and pee on the mountain, bud.
Yep. Yeah, when we were potty training, you've got to learn how to hit the brakes and pull over real quick, because if they say they got to go, you don't have time to wait for a gas station. You got to get pretty quick on the wheel.
Yeah, absolutely. Good stuff.
So how do you prepare? I guess going back to your first story where you're talking about how you're a little bit unprepared, you had cowboy boots and a jacket and stuff. How do you prepare now, not just physically, but mentally for a hunt?
You know, I think it starts with your fitness, Brian. Like if your fitness is on point, then your mental is on point. Like if you're challenging yourself in the gym, your diet's on point, and you're continually pushing yourself day in and day out, trying to push for PRs with weight, with cardio, with functional training, it fortifies your mind. So hunting, in my opinion, is 95% mental. Like getting to that next ridge, finding the animal. There's going to be a lot of failures on those hunts. You know, you can quit and go home, and most people do. Or how about when the weather moves in and you're absolutely miserable, you wake up to 2 feet of snow outside your tent. I mean, most people quit. But if you fortify your mind, starting with your training, then when you get that stuff and it hits you, it's not as bad. You don't want to quit. You're like, man, this isn't as bad as I thought. And guess what? All the bad stuff passes eventually, whether it's snow, weather, life, doesn't matter. If you can stick it out and make it through it, not only is it going to make you stronger, but I feel like it's God forging you into something greater. And I feel like the sweetest things I've ever seen on a hunt or in life or in my physical fitness and my training is when I pushed through some of those hard times. So to answer your question, it starts in the gym or however you're training. Could be at home, could be running, whatever. But that's how you get strong mentally.
A lot of times people think about hunting, especially new people, to be like, well, I got to get a weapon. Other than a weapon or a, you know, whatever tool you're going to use to take your game, what would you say is the most important piece of equipment that you bring along with you?
Gosh, I think your most important piece of equipment that you can bring with you, I think you got to survive like the elements, right? Like, I think you need a good layering system for sure. I don't know if there's any one answer. Okay, so I'm just going to give a bunch. So I think your layering system, you got to have good layering for early and late. You can't overheat, right? Especially if you're hunting Utah desert, August, high country, sometimes it could be 100, 105 degrees. But there's the blistering heat, but it still gets cold up there. You got to be able to dump heat. You got to be able to dry off quick. So you got merino layering, you got a puffy mid layer, and then an outer shell, and you got to make sure you have rain gear. So staying dry and all those kind of things are really important. The next critical piece, I think, is a GPS. We used to carry those handheld garments and whatnot, but now you have it all on your phone with, you know, like the Hunt Stand app, for example, where you can tell property boundaries, measure distances. You know, it's kind of a lifesaver when you're navigating the country that you've never been in. So you don't get into a spot where you're cliffed out or, you know, you weren't expecting the country to be this big. And, you know, and the other thing is probably water, especially your early season, like being able to filter your water, and then access water. Like we hunt areas all the time where we literally have to backpack in 10 to 12 liters on our back, which is 20, 25 pounds. And there's no water to filter in the mountains and there's no availability. So every decision you make to stalk or pursue an animal is based on your water availability. So it's like, oh, I can stalk that deer. It's probably 2 miles, but will I have enough water to A, stalk him and B, get back? Because if not, you're going to die. Overheat, heat exhaustion, whatever. Like it's a real thing and it happens to hunters every year. So, you know, I think you're layering your GPS and your water. I think that's some of the most important stuff you can do.
Yeah. When you're packing stuff up like that, obviously you have to keep weight in mind. You've packed too much gear. Obviously you're going to be over encumbered. Right. You're not going to be able to get very far. How do you approach kind of min-maxing your weight in your pack and loadout?
Yeah. So I try to stay under 45 pounds without water. And that's for like a 3 to 5 day trip. So if I can stay 40, 45 pounds without water, then I'm doing pretty good. So that means you got to have your optics, your sidearm, your bino harness, your you know, your pack, sleeping system, your food, and whatever weapon, whether you're shooting a long rifle or a bow, you've got to fit in that threshold. And that's why we're constantly refining our gear. We're looking at titanium spoons. We're looking at, you know, the lightest packs available. You know, we're looking at, you know, our sleep systems. We want a kit that with your, you know, your shelter is under a pound and a half, or your sleeping bag is under a pound. Like your lightweight puffies, you know, that's a big step, because every ounce stinking matters. Because I'd rather have lighter equipment for my shelter and for my clothing and all that kind of stuff, so I can pack more water. I'd rather go heavy on water, or I'd rather kill myself getting my water in there so that I know I can hunt how I want to hunt freely and not be constrained by being able to stalk an animal or chase something because I don't have enough water. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
So yeah, like just refining it all the time. Like, oh, you know, you got two power banks. Okay. How many charges do I get from this power bank versus how much does it weigh, and how many charges do I get from this power bank? And so like even just constantly refining your kit, like tiny fire starters that don't weigh anything, and every ounce matters. I cut my toothbrush in half a lot of times. Yeah. Just to save that extra weight, but it does a lot for you mentally. If you know that your kit is dialed, it gives you a ton of confidence on the mountain, right? Is that having being prepared translates to confidence in the field. Just like shooting your sidearm, right? If you know you're deadly with your freaking PDP, you don't fear, right? But if you're like, man, I'm not really comfortable loading this and not really comfortable shooting it, and then you get in a situation where you actually need it, yeah, you're screwed.
Yeah, who wants to walk out in the world with that lack of confidence in what they can do with their chosen firearm? Which I guess brings me to my next question. You mentioned sidearm. Obviously, we're on the Walther podcast. What Walther is it that you're carrying currently, and why did you choose that one?
I alternate between various colors of the PDP. And the reason why
various colors.
The reason why I do it is because I'm Gucci, man. I try to match my colors of my bino harness. So we have a very popular bino harness that's called the Game Changer. We have a black and tan version. We have a Ranger green version. And then we have a multicam version and a few other versions. But anyways, I just rotate between whatever color matches best with my bino harness.
Gotcha. So you don't, it doesn't have anything to do with slide length or grip length or capacity or anything. It's got to be about the color.
It's about the color, but I'm not super worried about mag capacity but I'm more worried about shootability, right? That this is one of the things I'm not going to sacrifice weight in carrying to the backcountry. I'll shave the weight on my toothbrush and my titanium spoon, and I'll pack the I'll pack the sidearm I'm most confident in. Like 3 years ago, my PDP, I had a red dot on it, and I'm going to go back to a red dot on this, but like I knew I could hit anything with that thing. Like there, it got into a situation where we were deep in the backcountry and I'd shot this bear at 1,008 yards and we weren't able to retrieve him that night. Right. And so we went in there to recover him the next day. And I didn't want a, 26 inch barrel with a 7-inch suppressor going in trying to track a wounded bear in the brush. No, we got the PDPs out. We're going in the brush after this bear with PDPs, so having a sidearm that you're confident in, I think is huge. And a lot of guys are like, man, you need a 10 for bears. I'm like, no, you don't. You need something you can shoot.
Yeah.
You need something.
I was going to ask if you felt like you were undergunned at that point. Cause obviously the 10 millimeter crowd or, even 45, we see a lot of that in like Instagram comments.
Yeah, absolutely not. No, it's like Seth and I always talk about on the Hornady podcast. Number one always beats number two, and number one shot placement. If you can put 4 or 5 bullets in this versus, maybe dinging one in there with a 10 or something that you're not as comfortable with or can't shoot, I'll take those 4 to 5 bullets any day, And I got friends in Alaska. I've asked the same question to them. And as long as you have the right bullet, you can sit a grizzly down with a 9, Hornady makes those big game hunter. I don't know if I think I have a box right here, but they're phenomenal for protection on
Is that
on
what you bears. Carry in your sidearm?
Yeah, let me see if it's right here. I'll show you a clip.
glimpse of it. No,
you can edit this. No, it's, but yeah, that's what I carry.
Oh, wow.
I don't know what your opinion is on it, but it's pretty hard to hit it. I think anybody's going to have a hard time hitting a charging bear.
Regardless of caliber.
But this bear was already wounded too. So I know, well, I mean, I didn't know if he's dead or wounded right at this point, but mm-hmm. I'm like, I know he's got to be hurting because I shot him right through the front of the chest and out the shoulder because he was facing me at 1,008 yards. And wow. So I'm like, he's already got one in him. So I got, if he isn't dead, all I've got to do is get another couple in him to slow him down. And I got a couple friends, buddies here that can pull him off me or something.
Hope their physical fitness is as high as yours.
Though. Yeah. But that's part
of, got their training in.
Exactly. But that's part of the adventure, right?
Yeah.
And you know, I never used to carry a sidearm. And you know, I think it's because I was so dang naive as a young farm boy growing up on the farm. You know, as a kid, you don't think anything can happen to you. And as you get older, you mature a little bit, you hear these stories, you maybe have an experience or two, and you realize, man, I'm not 10 feet tall and bulletproof. Mm-hmm. I better be a little bit more smarter about this.
Or bear proof.
Or bear proof or lion proof. Like there's things on Instagram and TikTok and stuff all the time where these cats are stalking and following people, you know, and they're not shying away from people shooting at them. Like, I don't know if you saw that one in Idaho where the guy's shooting at him, the thing's still coming after him. Or that one on the trail where that one puma had kittens and he's doing everything he can to scare her off. And she's like levitating at him and won't back off. So it's like, you know, and I got other friends that I've hunted with that they've turned around and all of a sudden there's a cat behind him. They had no idea there was a cat behind him. And all they have is a 26 inch barrel gun to hurry and try to swing around the hip like John Wayne and try to blast one versus, you know, having your sidearm right here in your bino harness or whatever and just being ready to go.
Right.
You know, these are things you don't think about until you're in the situation. So be prepared.
Well, hopefully you never get in that situation, but I'm glad you have a PDP in case you find yourself there. So
yeah, I hope I don't either. If I do, I hope you or Cody are with me.
Yeah, there we go. drop a bill drill on some kind of big cat.
Yeah, exactly.
Can you walk me through your approach to ethical hunting practices and kind of explain what that means to you?
I mean, I think it's ethical hunting practices is abiding by all laws. And I think it goes beyond that. You know, there's some laws that there's some things that aren't laws, but I think that should be ethical. For example, shooting at an animal and going to see if you hit the animal. A lot of people are just like, oh, I missed and take off. And they don't even go check to see if they drew blood or if they wouldn't. Because not everyone films their hunts like we do, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of times that, you know, people will hit something. They don't know they hit it because they're not filming it or, you know, phone digiscoping it or whatever. And just walk off. They don't realize that they wounded an animal. So a lot of states, that's not a law that after you shoot, whether it's with an arrow or with a bullet, that you have to go and check that. So, I mean, that's going beyond the law and going into the ethics portion, because I mean, deer and elk and whatever big game animal you're hunting, it's a resource that God put on this earth for us, right? It's not, and it only renews if we're responsible with it. And I think it comes down to responsibility and conservation, where you've got to be ethical and then lawful. And then also go beyond that and just think, be logical sometimes. Like, okay, I should go check if I hit this animal or not, because otherwise you're just wounding more animal. There's enough wounded animal on the highways in our winter, during our winters, right? That are getting killed on the highways. Like, as hunters, we need to do everything we can to preserve these animals for the next generation, for the next season. And that's why we're doing all these things, raising money at the Western Hunt Expo for conservation. And we're taking out, you know, obnoxious weeds and planting some of their natural, you know, vegetation, or, you know, trying to build corridors under the highways so that the deer and elk can funnel. And so they're not getting, you know, hit on the highways. I mean, conservation and ethics, and it goes way, way, way beyond the law, in my opinion.
Kind of coming off of that, in case of any of our listeners have Googled who are, maybe they're not familiar with Muley Freak or anything like that. Explain in your own words what Muley Gate was, and I guess what the status of that whole thing has been.
Yeah, I think, yeah, thanks to Jens kind of coined Muley Gate. It was a mule deer hunt, where I got landowner permission to hunt some mule deer in Idaho. I ended up shooting a buck off a landowner's property that I had permission to hunt, and I shot the boss's buck, who also had permission to hunt the same property. Well, the landowner was trying to keep me low key to the boss because he didn't want the boss to know, unbeknownst to me, that I had also had permission. So the boss had been watching this particular buck. Well, here comes along Muley Freak Eric. Unbeknownst to him, I had permission too. And I shot the buck that he'd been watching all summer. So obviously tempers flared on their side. And there were no deer that are off limits. There were no points of the property that I couldn't hunt. And, you know, they loaded the buck in my truck, sent me home, and they're like, well, you know, let bygones be bygones. And I was like, well, do you want me to come help you, honey? He's like, no, you guys just take the buck home and have a good day. Until 3-4 days later, I got a phone call. He had reneged on permission, and he had called a game warden and said that I never had permission to hunt. And I was literally just mind blown. I'm like, how could this even happen? Well, year later, it ultimately was dropped. All wildlife charges were dropped, but it was a scary situation. It taught me a lot. And that's what your listeners are probably thinking right now. Get it in writing. You know, I never thought that someone would pull the cart or the rug out from underneath another individual like that. But that was naive on my part. And ultimately, you know, like I said, the wildlife charges were dropped, but it was nothing more than initially a little bit of a witch hunt. And then, maybe a tiny bit of jealousy over the deer that was shot, but ultimately it was dropped and we're moving on from it. So
I find it interesting that it's so easy to find headlines about the charges being filed and almost none about them being dropped.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No,
isn't that great?
Yeah, I know it is great. We posted a podcast on it where we go into further detail, like exactly things that were said that were documented. But yeah, none of these are,
was it video? Of the guy giving you permission or photos of.
Okay. So I'll give you a little bit more context to this. So my wife had just had our fifth child. And so she told me that, hey, if you're going hunting, you're taking our 2-year-old and 3-year-old at the time up to get permission. So I drove my 2-year-old and 3-year-old up in the car with me to visit this landowner and get permission in his driveway. Okay. I already got permission earlier in the season. But I hadn't seen him for a while, right? Baby came, things got busy. So I'm like, I better just go remind him, hey, I'm still hunting, like whatever. Well, went in there, got permission, spent a few minutes with him. Well, I don't know if you have any kids, but they get on your phone a lot. And they get on your camera, especially. They're fascinated with the camera on the iPhone. So stop, record, stop. I don't know if you've ever looked at your smartphone. There's 100, if not 1,000 pictures and videos from your 2 or 3-year-old. It happens all the time. Well, I happened to be going through, looking at my photos and videos, and lo and behold, there were fragments of the conversation with the landowner, me getting permission. And also the most damning part for the landowner was him holding a gift that I had given him, thanking him for permission, which if it wouldn't, I think a 3-year-old literally saved my life and saved my business. If I'm being frank, because I had no evidence of permission other than it was a, he said sort of thing. I'm like, oh, wait a second. 3-year-old saves the day. Here we go. Here's the photos and videos of me getting permission. But wow. What a scary thing, right?
Yeah.
What a scary thing to put your entire livelihood and your business on the line for something as silly as written permission.
Yeah.
You know, but it protects everyone. And shame on me for not getting written permission.
Well, I mean, it's obviously a big lesson in that story. Yeah. Make sure you get written permission. I don't even know if I'll leave this part in the podcast, but that is really reminiscent. There's a story of a guy, I believe it was even here in Indiana where I am, where he bought an old sheriff car off eBay Motors and still had all the stickers all over it. Like it was still fully marked as a sheriff car. It was a brown and tan sheriff car. So he goes to the police precinct or whatever to pick the car up that he'd paid for. And a sheriff came out and like helped him load it onto the trailer. And he was like, this thing still has all the stickers all over it. And the guy's like, yeah, you know, well, whatever. We tried to get him removed and the place was busy. So just take your car or whatever. And he drove off. And of course he ended up making it look even more like a cop car. He knew what he was doing, but he ended up getting arrested for and charged with impersonating a police officer.
You're kidding. And
what ended up happening? What safe? They were like, there is no way that somebody sold you this car full code with all the stickers and stuff all over it. That would be illegal. So he went back to the place where he bought it and they were like, no, we would have never done that. And the police officer he bought it from said, we would have never sold him that with the stickers all over it. And he just happened to bring his daughter, bring his daughter with him the day that he picked it up. And she had a little digital camera, like a toy digital camera. And she took pictures of the police car being loaded onto the trailer by the sheriff.
You're kidding.
Never seen it before.
Yeah.
And same thing. All the charges got dropped and pretty wild that that story is that. That's similar. I'll send it to you if I can think of it after we're done recording.
But there you go. You know, since this happened to me, you know, hundreds of stories came through via DM and, hey, this happened to me, or we got this landowner permission to goose hunt, and another guy had permission to goose hunt, and he started some deal and landowner came at us mad. And but the difference is in those stories versus mine was they're not a muley freak. They didn't have a business. They weren't a big name. So, you know, the DA's attempt and this fish cop to crucify me, plenty of motive there, right? Because then they elevate their careers. I'm a part of their resume, you know, lots of things. It was hard for them to drop this. Very, very, very hard. And which is the unfortunate part too, because if it's anyone else, it's completely gone right off the bat. Right. Drop. No, it's me. So I've got to fight tooth and nail.
Well, I'm certainly glad that worked out for you. It seems like somebody was looking out for you for sure.
Oh, for sure.
We're able to have that photo taken by your child just at that moment. That's awesome.
So the learning lesson is cross your T's and dot your I's, because weird things happen. Case in point, the cop with the guy that bought the cop car from the cops that had full code and stickers on it. Like weird things happen. And if someone can cover their butt and it saves them, they're not going to try to save you. And so you just got to be. You just got to be extra careful. Extra careful.
Yeah. What are some common misconceptions that people have about hunting, and how do you address those?
That we're killers. And we are. And to be a good hunter, you got to be a killer. But we're also conservationists, and we care more for those animals than PETA does. And what I mean by that is we're out there doing helicopter drops, doing blood sampling, building tunnels, spending millions of dollars building tunnels underneath highways. I'm saddened when I see this highway mortality going from Morgan to Evanston, Wyoming, and all these pile up of dead deer and dare elk. It saddens me, you know. And here's the weird part: we'll save a deer, but then kill one at the same time. But we don't just kill to kill. A lot of times we're looking for the oldest, the most mature, depending on, you know, how the winter has been for certain types of animals and certain units. We're not killers. We're conservationists. And guess what? Guess where all our hunting and conservation and license dollars go? It goes to the state, who pay employees to protect and preserve these animals, run biology studies. If it wasn't for hunters, there would be no wildlife, because it would be lawless, right? People would be going out shooting whatever, wasting it. You know, poachers would run rampant. It is because of hunters that we have wildlife. And that's the part that people don't understand. You know, no one's more saddened by hunters, by frivolous mortalities than us. And people encroachment. Do you think these people, these PETA people who are building these fancy homes on the benches of the winter ranges of these animals, they don't, if they really cared about these animals, they wouldn't be building multi-million dollar homes on the winter range of these animals during the winter, when these animals are fighting to survive and taking all their feed away, their crucial winter feed. You know, it's because of hunters that we, not only that we have hunting, but that we have wildlife to enjoy. And it's not just all about hunting. We like just viewing them, right? We like just looking at them. I like teaching people about how neat they are, you know? So it stretches far beyond just the killing part, so.
How do you stay connected with nature, I guess, is if you want to phrase it that way? How do you find yourself really kind of becoming one with your area when you're on a hunt?
I think just observing, right? I think a lot of times, you know, we don't shoot the first buck we see. We'll sit and study them and admire them and learn different habits and of these different creatures. Like, for example, buck one and buck number two might have totally different personality types, and it's kind of seeing them, observing them, seeing how they act, how they interact. And if you observe them long enough, you're like, oh man, he likes to sleep right there. That's where he takes his 2 o'clock nap. Okay. He's going to be at 4 o'clock. He likes to be over here and take a nap over here on this side hill underneath this piece of brush. So it's staying connected in nature. And while you're sitting there, you're learning about plants and other animals and species that you've never seen before. Watching that chipmunk run around, and, you know, he's trying to take some parts of your granola bar, and it's, and then the smells of the pine, and then, you know, the rush of the underbrush, and there's just so much to be connected with. And a lot of times we're out of cell service. And so there's just a lot of peace. And I think it's, at times this is the closest you can be to God, is in his creation like that.
What are your thoughts on the future of hunting, particularly in the face of social changes,
man,
political changes?
I'm not going to lie. I'm pretty nervous for the thoughts on the future of hunting. And here's why. You know, with the likes of Stephen Rinella, Cameron Haynes, Joe Rogan's new to hunting, probably the last 6 or 7 years. There's some good parts of it, in the sense that more and more people are understanding the ethics, the laws, why we hunt, how we consume these animals, how they're delicious, healthier for our bodies, and so on. But at the same time, it's bringing more popularity to hunting, right? So it's getting harder and harder as the human population grows. It's getting harder and harder to obtain tags, because, you know, a lot of these states who were traditionally and historically over-the-counter opportunities, meaning that you could go to a gas station or any agency, state agency, and pick up a tag, you can't do that anymore. And then additionally, on a more negative side, the encroachment piece I was talking about, how we're building homes in their habitats, and so they're not wintering as well. The human population kills far more deer than hunters do, far more, you know. And I'm worried about the future of hunting in that sense, that number one, the population is growing, and so we've got to put homes and buildings somewhere, right? And then these people are getting upset because these deer, they're calling them urban deer, are coming in and living in the neighborhoods, and the people are complaining that the deer are eating their brand new, you know, $500 trees and shrubs and whatnot. So what do? They institute a bow hunt in the urban parts of the town, and then we're just knocking down more population, right? So, you know, conservation and hunting is more important than it ever was. With a growing human population, more buildings and everything else, it's now's the time to stand up and let your voice be heard and be more responsible, because the over-the-counter opportunities to hunt when and wherever are diminishing. So with that, though, it makes me personally appreciate hunting more. It means more to me now, because, as you know, Chris, when things are taken away from you, that's when you sort of appreciate them, whether it's someone in your life or some sort of freedom. When it's taken away from you, it's like, man, I didn't appreciate, you know, that I could do this. You know, case in point, COVID, when they took all our freedoms away. Like, yeah. Oh, man, I can't believe they used to let me go to church. Now they don't even let me go to church, and I got to watch it over Zoom. Man, I sure loved when I could actually go to church. But before that, you're like, man, I hate going to church. Or, gosh, I got to go to church today. That's 3 hours long. But then when they took it away from us, we're like, man, I love to go to church. Same thing, you know.
Are there any technological advances that you're looking forward to, or maybe we're starting to see the beginning of, that you're wanting to see fleshed out, as far as gear or, you know, like optics or anything like that in the future?
You know, I think there's some unfair things, technologies out there in the marketplace. I think one of them is the Garmin Zero Sight. I don't think that's fair for a bow hunter. And I don't know how familiar you are with that, but it's a...
No, can you go...
Yeah, so basically, traditionally, you're bow hunting, right? You see an animal, you range it with your rangefinder, whether it's in your binoculars or a handheld rangefinder. You get a range, you have a certain pin, or you have a dial on your bow sight where you dial it. So for example, deer's at 47 yards, I'm going to either use my 50 pin, or I'm going to dial exactly to 47 yards and I shoot. So it's an extra step, right? You've got a range, and then dial your sight or match it up with your pin based on the range of that animal. Well, the Garmin Zero Sight is, you literally pull up, and on that grip, there's a little button where you can auto range the animal. You don't need to take that step of handheld ranging or dialing your sight. What happens is you grip your bow, hit the little button on your bow with one hand, and it will adjust that pin based on the yards automatically for you. So there's no guessing involved. Bow hunting is supposed to be more primitive, right? We're already using compound bows. We have expandable broadheads. shooting 70, 80 pounds in some cases, right? I shoot a 72, 73 pound bow. It's just not fair. And so here in Utah, we have a new technology committee who is instituting law legislative changes to make it more fair for the animals. And one of the things they're doing is taking scopes off muzzleloaders. So they felt like that was unfair because I shot a deer at 500 yards 3 years ago with a muzzleloader, and I thought that was absolutely amazing. Now, not all of them I agree with, right? Yeah, the Garmin side, I feel like it's unfair, especially because it's bow hunting. It's supposed to be a primitive sport, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, muzzleloader is too, but I was a little bit upset that they aren't going to allow us here in the state of Utah have more than a one-power scope. So, but, you know, as hunters are getting better. I don't know how familiar you are, but, you know, we didn't have rangefinders growing up. You know, when we're on the saddle horse, I say, "Grandpa, how far is that deer?" Like, "Man, I don't know, 200-300 yards." In some cases, it was 500. And of course we missed. But now with these modern rifles, you know, you got these proof barrels, you know, these Night Force scopes. It's easy. 500 yards, that's a slam dunk. You know what I mean? 500 yards is easy.
Yeah.
Where back then, 500 yards might as well have been 1,300.
Right.
For those 30-30s, 30-06s, and some of those old rifles and scopes we had.
What are some ways that hunters can give back to the communities and the ecosystems they engage with? Kind of going back maybe 10 minutes ago when we were talking about, you know, hunting ethically and depopulation in urban areas and things.
Yeah, I think hunters can give back by volunteering, like with their local agencies, be a part of some cleanup program. I mean, but more easily is just being good in the mountains, man, being kind to other people, being kind to other hunters, helping each other rather than, you know, ragging on each other or, you know, quarreling, like helping one another out. Someone gets an animal. Hey, do you need help with that? Hey, can I help you do this? Can I help you clean, quarter that? And picking up trash. You know, it could be that easy. Just there's always trash, whether it's an old sardine can or an old round that you find somewhere. I think it can be as simple as just making the area around you, whether you're on public or private, just better.
Yeah, I know out west there's a lot of BLM land and things, and I know there's different online communities that'll host cleanup days and things like that, which I always thought was really cool to see. It'd be shotgun shells and, you know, steel casings and stuff like that everywhere that people go out and pick up. I think it was really cool.
Yeah, and clean up after yourself too. I mean, that's an easy one. What you take in, take out.
Yeah. How do you deal personally with setbacks? How often would you say that you deal with setbacks too, or just disappointments, you know, disappointing hunts and things like that? And then how do you deal with it?
You know, I'd say I deal with setbacks every single week in business, right? We have, you know, gear that we're trying to get out the door. We have retailers and orders we're trying to fulfill. I mean, back when you first launched the PDP, man, PDP, you couldn't even find one of those, you know? And there's the setbacks of having too much inventory and not enough. And so we face challenges and setbacks every day. And, you know, your motivation leaves fast. I'm rarely ever motivated, Chris. But
I doubt that.
But. Yeah, I do have hints of big motivation, but it's more about being disciplined, right? I don't wake up and want to go to the gym. There's very few days that I'm like, yeah, man, I can't wait to go torture myself at the gym. No, it's a matter about doing it. And I think it's the same with work and life, dealing with setbacks. It's like, okay, I can throw a fit, which I've done, okay, when something hasn't gone my way, or I can choose to be like, okay, I can't control this, but here's what I can control. I can't control my attitude. Because if you're only happy when things are good, you're not going to be very happy in life. You're just not. Mm-hmm. And so just dealing with it and maintaining equanimity is the word. It's you're never high, you're never low, you're always the same. And no matter if things are really great or really bad, you maintain an equanimity, you're always good. And you can always deal with whatever life throws at you. And, you know, going through some of the hard times makes you tough.
Yeah.
It forges you. If you didn't go through hard stuff, you'd be soft as heck. You know, so.
Yeah, well, they say hard times create strong men.
That's right.
Yeah. Have you had any stories where maybe you were dealing with unintended wildlife? Like cool story, you know, maybe like a squirrel crawled up your jacket sleeve or something like that. Has anything like that ever happened to you?
Oh, nothing in the squirrel realm, but we've definitely dodged some rattlesnakes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Rattlesnakes, especially in some of our backcountry bear hunts, some of our elk hunts, hiking in the middle of the night. Luckily, we've never been bitten, but it's mm-hmm. it's something that I, as long as I try not to think about them, they don't manifest. Okay. But my cameraman, okay. who's absolutely terrified of rattlesnakes, who's always thinking about them, he manifests them. So yeah. he sees them all the time. So I try to remind him, like, hey, man, stop thinking about rattlesnakes or we're going to start seeing them. Sure enough, this last year, I'd never seen a rattlesnake in this spot. And he'd been worrying about it. We're going over this rock cropping, this scree field. Sure enough, giant rattlesnake and an aggressive one. So never had any issues with, you know, running into mountain lions, bears chasing us. Sure, I've run into them. Never had issues with us. We, 2-3 years ago, we stashed some food, carried some in. We were coming back to it, and this bear ended up eating all our freeze-dried meals and trashed them. And so then we had to end up picking all this slobbery trash up and hauling that out. And I didn't have a meal for a night or two because I was planning on that. Those meals still being up there, but yeah, nothing too crazy.
What would you say the funniest thing? You have like one hilarious story has happened on a hunt.
So we're packed in on a backcountry bear hunt, right? And we're in a long ways. Like you'd never make it out hiking out. Imagine helicopter dropped off middle of nowhere, and we packed all our food in. Well, we just killed that giant bear at 1,008 yards. Actually, it's back to that story. And they'd killed a bear in another drainage over. So they split up. They went and took care of that bear. And my bear was really big, so I was going to have a heck of a time going out by myself. So I wasn't going to haul my bear all the way down and follow them and get theirs out, because then I'd be going like 3 times the distance. So I went back, got back to camp. So naturally, I'd been gone all day. I'm starving to death, right? I've been packing out this bear on my back all by myself. We get back to camp, and I'm sitting down there, and I'm like eating some dry tuna fish on a tortilla. I'm like, man, it should be nice to have some real food. You know, like, you know, the job's done, the hunt's over. I'm like, man, it should be nice. And I saw some sour straws sticking out of my buddy's tent. Like just, okay. And like, I saw the pink and the yellow and the red. I'm like, man, those look delicious. So I went over and I'm like, man, he'll never notice if I eat one or two. So obviously my body needs sugar. Like I've been busting my tail, right? My body was just craving sugar. So I ate one or two. Well, one or two turned into three or four, and then three or four turned into five and six. Before I knew it, I devoured his entire bag of sour straws. I'm like, no. Oh, I'm like, what am I going to do? I'm like, I got to hide the evidence. So I took his bag of sour straws and hit it. Well, I lit a fire, and I'm like, when are these guys coming back? And sure enough, I see headlamps on the horizon, and 3 hours later, they show up at camp, and you know, we shared stories, this, that, and the other. And he's then about half hour later, he starts digging around his tent looking for sour straws. He's like, "Dude, I swear I packed these sour straws in here. Where are they?" I'm like, "I don't know, man." And he just will not give up that he can't find his sour straws. Finally, I'm like, "Dude, maybe a rat or squirrel or something ran off with him. I don't know. You probably didn't have them secured." And it wasn't until like after the trip was over that I finally, he was just perplexed that he'd realized that I finally was like, "Hey dude, I ate your sour straws." He was like, no way. And that was a good
story. At least
you
gave him peace of mind that he wasn't crazy.
Yeah. He's like, "Dude, I swear I packed it." I'm like, "No, I don't think you did, dude." I'm just ravaging his treat bag, 'cause I'm just starving, right?
Oh, that is funny. Well, again, since we're on the Walther podcast, let's cover one final pistol topic. If you grab your PDP, whichever color you prefer that day, and you head to the range, what are you practicing?
I'm practicing how quickly I can unholster and get on target.
Mm-hmm. So draw to one shot type of stuff.
Yep. Draw to one shot. Because
you ever do like B8s for accuracy or anything like that? Or is it mostly just draws?
Mostly just draws. And I do that just in case I have to pull up and shoot something quickly,
sure.
Whether it's a cat, charging bear, whatever. That's typically what my focus is. Yeah. Just getting comfortable with it, right? Mm-hmm. Being able to be confident and I say this all the time, confidence kills. And that doesn't matter if you're bow hunting, rifle hunting, or trying to protect yourself.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of guys.
I assume you practice in your daily carry. Where do you ever go out and practice, like with your with it as your sidearm, like in full kit?
No, not typically. I should more, I'll be honest. And I ran through all that stuff with Cody. I just need to be more disciplined about that. But a lot of times, like the only time hunters carry, or let's see, hold on, let me back up. It's disappointing because a lot of times the only time, let's see, hold on, back up again. A lot of times hunters who carry pistols don't ever shoot them. Mm-hmm. And what good's that going to do to you? If you, I mean, sure, I guess you have it, but if you're not shooting it, what good's it going to do you if you get into that situation? And I feel like I need to be more disciplined of that too. Like that's something I could be better at, right? I mean, I'm calling myself a professional hunter. Like I should shoot this more. And we all could shoot more, right? I think we all could, yeah, whether it's your bow or your rifle or your sidearm. But I think this is the one that gets neglected. Like you should practice shooting this and drawing and everything else.
Yeah. Well, you did, you got to see, well, actually you were the, one of the only people who got to put hands on the Meister manufacturer rattlesnake pistol that we had at SHOT Show. If there was a Eric Muley Freak signature Meister cost is no object PDP, what would that look like?
Deer antler, man.
Deer antler.
Okay. Yeah. Have some custom engraved mule deer here, maybe a little bit of, antler in the grip, maybe some ivory somewhere from an elk. I don't know. Ooh, I think that like the bottom, the mag have some sort of ivory element. I think that would be really cool. Cause that rattlesnake was next level. It sold. Yeah.
Oh, it sold before the show even started. Yeah. A guy walked by, before the show started and he was like, is that for sale? And we were like, yeah, you know, 30 grand. And he's like, I've got it sold. It's done. And he came back 5 minutes later after he made a phone call and it was done. It's
yeah.
Gone.
Yeah. That's insane. I imagine if you did
something happened last year.
What was it last year? Was it rattlesnake?
We had two. We had, I think it was called the crocodile. It was obviously, it was obviously crocodile skin looking like it was hand engraved to look like crocodile skin.
Oh, that's cool.
The alien, it kind of looked like a xenomorph from the alien movies, was kind of engraved all over it. But I thought the rattlesnake was the coolest one I've seen so far, in my opinion.
But I think if you did something with some antler or some ivory, that would be pretty sick.
That would be cool.
Yeah. So there you go. Whoever made that, there's your next idea.
Seriously. Yeah. We've got our marching orders now. We can, we've got our project planned out for us. So, that is, all the time that I have. That is all the time that we have and, all the questions that I had to cover. So, Eric, where can people learn more about you?
MuleyFreak.com. Obviously you can plug your email in there, get a part of our email list. We have a lot of stuff there. Also YouTube channel. We do a lot of educational stuff, talking about bears and wildlife and all sorts of things, guns, ammo, archery stuff, all the things there. And then you can join our private Facebook group. It's the Muley Freak Syndicate, where we go into more depth and things are a little bit more personal over there. You got to answer a few questions and be admitted into there. But and we have our own little podcast too. It's called The Grind Podcast, where we go over tips, tricks. We go behind the scenes on a lot of our hunts and then also talk about entrepreneur stuff and what it takes to earn success. So
cool. And that's available, I'm assuming, wherever podcasts can be found.
Yep, wherever podcasts can be found.
Awesome. Well, Eric, super happy to have you. I'm very glad that you spent this hour with us and really proud to call you a friend of Walther. So thanks so much for stopping by. And
thanks.
I'm sure we'll have you back again.
Thanks, brother. Thanks, friends. Can't wait to get on a squirrel hunt with you guys over there in Arkansas again.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Walther Radio. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. At Walther Arms, it's our duty to create the world's best performing firearms. It's your duty to be ready. Thanks again for listening.